Okay, ladies, we are on.
I'll
do it at the end. We are on sheet. We're on sheet 5. I hope you found this sheet was a brain-stretching sheet. Lots of very deep ideas. Let me just get through some of the ideas first. This whole concept, which is very well known, I'll go back to that, which is very well known that the Torah precedes the world in some way, is rooted in real sources. We just have to understand what it means. It's a very popular idea as well. It's a Kabbalistic idea. You'll see it's rooted in the Zohar as well. And it does the rounds. People talk about this idea a lot. Was anyone in this room familiar with that, at least the statement that somehow the Torah was preceded the world?
Yeah?
So somehow or other that came through to you in high school. But I want to look at it a little bit in more depth here, obviously, and a little bit get a bit more sophisticated idea of what it is. We see this in number one very clearly. It's a Gemara in Shabbos. All the Gemaras that deal with Matan Torah, many of them are here in Shabbos, Pei Ches around the Pei. They deal with all the Matan Torah issues. So let's look at this one inside. Amar Rav Shua ben Levi, B'Shah She'ala Moshe L'Maram, Amar Malchi Asharis Levi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ribbono Shel Olam, so the Malachim said, Ribbono Shel Olam, Ma Yulud Isha Beinenu, why is there a human being here? One of the underlying questions in this whole sheet, in this whole topic is, how does the finite world interface with the infinite world? Human beings are finite, God is infinite, Torah is somewhere in between. Torah comes from an infinite source, Min HaShamayim, but somehow interacts and interfaces with a finite world. There is even this image, which I didn't bring you on the sheet, which maybe I will bring next year, it's a source I just thought of putting on, which is this image of Moshe Rabbeinu holding the Luchos. And it says the Luchos were 6 tfachim long. So God's holding the top 2. Moshe's holding the middle 2. And there's this kind of tug of war where Moshe's trying to pull the Luchos down and God's kind of holding them back. And it's the middle 2 which is... there's the idea that you're trying to fit the wrong hole, the wrong lead into the wrong hole. How can you get a finite world to speak to an infinite system? So the Malachim are saying, why is there a finite human here? Amalehem, he said to them, Lekabel Torah. He's come to receive the Torah. Amru Lefano, so the Malachim says to God, Chamuda, Genuza, this precious, hidden away, special thing, Shegnuza Lecha, Tesh, Chama, Otu Shivim, Varbam, Doiris, Kaidim, Shnivra, Oilam. This was already hidden away, this Torah, 974 generations before the world was created. And now you're planning to give it to a human. So what's going on here? Where is this number plucked from the air? 974 generations. Where does that come from? So did you work out where that came from? Michal, you answering the question or are you asking a question? So first of all, I want someone to answer the question. It takes a lot longer than you think, right? Okay, don't worry, because we're recording. So, you go on? Yeah, okay. We've only just started, so you didn't miss much yet. This idea that the Torah was created 974 generations before the world. Can someone tell me where that number comes from? What's source number 2 say? Zachar la'orim britoi davat tziva le'elef dor. What does that mean? This was a Brit which was commanded to the 1,000th generation. The Torah was given to generation 1,000. Let me ask you a question. How many generations from the creation of Adam are there until the Torah was given in the Torah? 26. Thank you for thinking a little bit out of the box. Okay? There are 26 generations. You probably knew that anyway. There are 10 generations from Adam to Noah. There are 10 generations from Noah to Avram. And if you work it out, there are 6 generations through down to Moshe Rabbeinu. You work it through Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Levi, Kaz, Amram, etc., etc.
There are how many? 26?
26 generations. So it's saying that the Torah was given to the 1,000th generation. What does that mean? There's the 26 that we know about, and there's the 974 that came before creation. What does that mean that 974 generations came before creation? There are no generations. There are no people.
And there's no time.
And there's no time as well, which kind of introduces us to the number three, which is another midrashic source from Chazal. The Amar Rebbe Hunu b'Shem Reish Lakish, Shnei Alafim Shana Kadma Torah L'Bris Olam. Torah preceded the world by 2,000 years. This is another number that we need to work out what that means. By the way, it doesn't really fit so easily with 974 generations either. Like, you know, two years a generation. So what are, there's no time, and Ibn Ezra made that point later on. You saw that Ibn Ezra? Just let me for a second mention that Ibn Ezra, the Ibn Ezra number 12, who says that this, he gives this an example. Look at number 12 just for a second. Yesh drash hafash drash, there's different midrashim that seem to oppose each other. The yesh lem lo yisod, there are deeper meanings, he says. It's not so clear. Kudrash, and he gives an example, that the Torah was 2,000 years before the world. But ze'emet, this is true. Rak al sod, but it's only true on a hidden, more mystical level. Derech ha'ne'elam, in a hidden way. Obviously, he says you can't take that literally. V'rabim lo yavinu kein, many people don't understand this right. I'm on 12 just for a second. The Ibn Ezra is saying many people don't get this clear in their head. And what's the reason he gives that the Torah can't possibly be given 2,000 years? Or existed 2,000 years before creation. What's the reason the Ibn Ezra gives? Did you get that? Yes, Esther. There was no time, like I just said, that time is a product of revolutions of the sun, of the earth around the sun. You know? There's no sun, there's no earth, there's no days, there's no minutes, there's no years. None of it makes sense. By the way, the same can be asked of the first six days of creation, which is how can these be days when the solar system was only created on the fourth day? That means at least the first 3 days can't possibly be days in the way that we know days, because if there's no sun and there's no earth, there's no day. In which case, what does it mean that the Torah was created in 6 days? So I'm not asking that question right now. Other people talk about that, which is not for now. Obviously, Hoffman has a lot to say about that. I'm asking this even more so about generations that existed before the world, when there was no people and there was no time at all. Jessica?
Is this like related to the concept that like, the Torah uses human instruments to be able to understand it?
Definitely. Definitely. Right. Definitely. Definitely. That's part of the answer, but I'm not getting into that whole discussion now. Yes, Hani. The Ibn Ezra simply makes the point that you made yourself, which is that you can't understand this literally because there were no days and hours. And
it's just saying that it's not true.
He's saying it is true. It's emet. But you have to understand it on a deeper level. We have to get deeper into this to understand what it's really all about. Yes, of course not. But you all knew that already. Right, Aria? Right. Exactly. So have a look now, please, in numbers 4 through 6, all express the same idea. I'm not going to look at them all inside, but they're all an idea that somehow the Torah was used as the blueprint for creation. So number 4 is this beautiful medrash that says when a king builds a palace, so he doesn't build it from his own mind. He employs professionals and they don't make it up. They use plans. There's these words, diftraos, pinkasaos, whatever they... I don't know exactly what they are. They're like blueprints and plans and books. There's a system. They all use a guide, a manual, in order to build the building. So too, look at the last line. Kach HaYakadosh Baruch Hu, in source 4. Kach HaYakadosh Baruch Hu mabit b'Torah. What's mabit? What's lahabit? He looked into the Torah, Ubayra es ha'olam, and created the world. The HaTorah Amra, because the Torah says, Bereshit bara Elokim. Now, what are the first Rashi on the Torah? What does it mean, Bereshit? Bereshit. In the beginning, except it doesn't mean that. Bereshona is in the beginning. So what does Bereshit? So Rashi says, Bishvil Reshit. For the sake of Reshit. And Reshit means a number of things. Reshit means the Jewish people. Reshit means the Torah itself. And here it says, Ein Reshit Ela Torah. Actually, Rashi there is quoting from a pasuk in Mishlei, in Perichet, in Mishlei, where the Torah calls it, it talks about the Torah as being Reshit. By the way, that Rashi is very important. It's slightly off topic here, but it's not totally off topic. Because that Rashi is saying that the very first word of the Torah is telling you not how the world was created, but why the world was created. Again, the Torah itself, the very first word, Rashi comments and says that if you think the Torah is a guide to tell you how the world was created, you're reading the Torah wrong. The Torah is a guide to tell you why the world was created. Rabbi Sacks, quoted by Rabbi Emmet at the beginning of the year, and I quote him again. Rabbi Sacks says that science takes things apart to see how they work, and religion puts things together to see what they mean. Okay?
Therefore,
Bert Reshit is saying that it was made for a purpose. That purpose is the Torah. But still we need to understand, what does it mean that God looks into this Torah? What is this Torah that is giving the world purpose? One of the main fights that we have with the secular world is not evolution and the Big Bang and all that stuff. That's science. It's the idea of, is there any purpose to this world? Or is it simply random? That's really at the bottom line what this is all about. Is there a purpose? And we say very much, yes, there is a purpose to this world. What is that purpose? Okay, go away and work it out. That's complicated. But if you say this world is meaningless and purposeless, just randomly created, so that we disagree with strongly. We may agree on the science of evolution on the planet, but that's not the issue. The issue is meaning, not science. Similarly, the Zohar, just one second, these two Zohars, quite famous, number 5, Be'oraita Baruch Kutcha Brichu V'Alma, the God looks in the Torah, creates the world, again, same idea. Number 6 says the people who are keeping the Torah are upholding the world, just like God looks into the Torah and creates the world, so too people connect with, interact with the Torah, and they sustain the world. These are all coming from the same ideas. Now, you had a question, Joy.
Yes, so I understand it's complicated, but these, like, three sources, when they talk about the Torah, do they mean, like, the ideas and principles of Torah, or the actual written Torah with all, like, the stories that had not yet happened?
Good. So, obviously, from the tenor of your question, it's clear that you don't believe the latter.
Issues with the latter.
Well, what do you mean issues? It can't possibly be correct. I mean, there was a Torah with all the stories in it, and that's what God looks into. So let me answer your question by explaining a source that you skipped on the way. The Radvaz, which I'm not going to read in full, but just so you know what it's all about in number 10. The Radvaz asked Joy's question, but he asked it in a very pointed and interesting way. The Radvaz, I'm going to go back to for sure 7, 8, 9, but I want, since the question came up now, I just want to address it now. You know the Medrash. Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to Shemayim to get the Torah. The Malachim go crazy, and they say to God, you can't give this person the Torah. By the way, midrashically speaking, what does it mean that the Malachim rebel against God? What is a Malach? They have to do God's will. A malach is an extension of God's will. A malach is the way that God, the ultimate infinite unity, somehow interfaces with this world, which is finite and bifurcated. It's cut into pieces. There's no unity. Oh, so what does that mean? So what does that mean that the malachim rebel against God? So the purpose of the malachim is to carry out the cause and effects of the world. The Malachim are systems. Think of them as bureaucrats. You know what I mean by bureaucrats?
Yep.
People who just do what they do. They're not paid to think, they're just paid to do. God runs this world through systems, not directly intervening. Those systems are how everything works in the world. When God is about to do something that completely goes against the system, that, midrashically, says the Beis Halevi, is represented by the midrashic concept, the Malachim are rebelling against God. Obviously, there's no actual rebellion of the Malachim against God, but it means... It is. God's will, God interacts in this world through the Malachim. So that's why occasionally, God does something that overrides the system, Adiva loy malach, and the malachim go nuts. Because the malachim are saying, you can't do that.
By Mitzrayim,
by Matan Torah, by the creation of the human being. These are all things basically where the bureaucrats... Yes, these are midrashim that all say that the malachim rebel at those stages. It's basically like the... Right, it's the bureaucrats saying, you can't do that, you don't have the paperwork.
So God interacts with... Every country has its own malach except for Eretz Yisrael, which is only sustained by God himself.
So that's an interesting question as to how that fits in.
Yeah.
Like, does that mean that everything that happens... This is all midrash, but I'm trying to explain... We'll have to think about that further. But I'm just explaining what it means that the midrash... When the midrash says the malachim rebel. So let's just get this clear. Go back to Joy's question. Joy's question is like this. What Torah is it that they're being given? That Moshe is being given, that the Malachim are upset about. So you know the end of the Medrash. I didn't bring the whole thing, but God says to Moshe, okay, you answer the angels. You tell them about him why you're entitled to the Torah. So what does Moshe say? I'm sure you learned the Midrash at school. No, not quite. That's another, something like that. But what does Moshe say to the Malachim to justify him taking the Torah? So the Midrash says he goes and he says to him, okay, you don't want us to have the Torah, right? So what's in the Torah? It says, do not murder. It says the Malachim, do you murder? Do you have jealousy? Do you kill each other? And the Malachim will go, That's good. This guy's good. Then he says, honor your parents. That's what it says in the Torah. Do you have parents? And the Malachim are all kind of looking at each other going, whoa, that's great. Do not commit adultery. Do you marry each other? And the Malachim go, oh, this is great. This guy, you can have the Torah. Beautiful. Medrash. So the Radvaz asks, Rabbanu Shel Olam, what's going on here? He's telling them stuff that's in the Torah. They didn't know that. What's he telling them that they don't know? How? Well, yeah, the whole Medrash makes no sense. Look at the words I've underlined in number 10. Well, look at the words I've underlined in number 10. The Yesh Lahakshav, just in the tshuva there, where it says tshuva, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines from the top, so where it says tshuva, look at the full stop. The Yesh Lahakshav, I want to ask the question. Did they not know the answer to that question? Elamai is lachalameimah, what can you say here? Sheheim hayukairim b'Torah kriya acheret ruchanit b'lo pisuk tevot. When they were reading the Torah, they were reading a completely different Torah. When Moshe comes up and stands and says, I'm taking the Torah, they think that he's taking what? The Torah. The spiritual, original Torah, which we'll discuss what that is. The primordial Torah. He says to them, actually the Torah that I'm really here to take is like a parchment with ink on it, and it says things like don't steal from other people and don't kill and don't commit adultery. And the Malachim will turn around and go, that's the Torah? Oh, fine. You can take that. That's not that. We thought you were here to take that. Like, the real Torah. The original Torah. And Moshe says, no. And they say, and everyone's happy. No, it hasn't. It has, because it's clear that when we talk about the Torah existing prior to, they're talking about a different level of Torah. Obviously not. He says, Loi pisuk tevos, there weren't even any words.
Yeah.
Meaning, and this brings us into the Ramban, which we're going to see in a minute, which is the Torah can be read on different levels. Meaning you can either read it with the words that we've got, or you can put all the words together. The Ramban gives an idea that when the Torah was originally given, it was given without any spaces between the words, so you can divide it up however you like. The way we divide it up is the way that makes sense on a physical level. Do not steal. Loitil tach, loitin up, etc. But if you reorganize the word divisions, then it spells a completely different thing, which is a Kabbalistic level of Torah, which is moving towards, but is not the same as, but moving towards the primordial Torah. But the Torah that we're talking about is not the Torah. That's the answer to George's question. It's not the Torah with the commandments and with the stories, etc., etc. It's a whole abstracted level beyond that. Yes,
but,
Esther?
That mean that we got the complete Torah?
We got the Torah insofar as it was the most abstract but the most crystallized version that we could cope with. But there are higher level abstractions to the Torah beyond the one that we got, but we just can't relate to them. That's why we're still going to talk about white fire and black fire. We got the Torah that God wanted us to get. But there is a Torah which goes, if you like, beyond that and before that and behind that.
Kabbalah.
Yes, which is the deeper mystical Torah which ultimately merges with God himself. Yes, Michal.
Is it ever possible to attain the Ramban?
Yes, we'll talk about the Ramban now a little bit, yes.
The second part was, we learned at the very beginning about, Hatima, that the Torah wasn't even, fully written down until the end of the 40th year.
Right.
So how can there be, this written Torah?
But they can't. That underlines the answer to your question. That's another reason why you can't be talking about the written Torah we have now, because even after Har Sinai, we didn't have that Torah for 40 years.
So when Moshe
you're just underlining the answer.
So when Moshe went up and had to argue for something from the Malachim, was it this Luchot? Is that what he was trying to?
It's interesting, the examples he gives are from the Luchot. Lotisach, Lotisinach, Lotis, and Kibbud Av Ha'Em. Presumably because that's the Torah he's most immediately interfacing with. Yeah, one more question, then go on. Yes, Ellie.
Couldn't the first Luchot maybe have been the spiritual Torah?
Oh, you mean, because the first Luchot were already like the Beis HaLevi says all the Torah Shebaal Peh. I think this is a level even before the Luchos. This is the white fire. We'll look at Rabbi Cardozo's writing in a minute. Look at the Ramban, number 7 and 8. Ori, are you with us?
Five.
I need to keep you with me. Okay, night times for sleeping, day times for learning.
Can we do
five? No, but it doesn't matter. Okay. Don't worry about it. We kind of, I talked about it. Right, do you want a cup of coffee? All right, you can have some of mine if you like. Look at number 7. Look at number 7. Do you want, is it too warm in here? Or is it just nice?
No, it's good.
You guys should drink Starbucks before the class. I don't mind putting chemicals into you if that helps. You know? Red Bull. I'll buy Red Bull for the class, you know? Belina.
Yeah? Yeah.
Okay, Belina, you know. If you really need it. We can work it out, Oreo. Look at number 7. So the Ramban, this is another very important source that you should know about. 7 is another Zohar, which is a Raisa Kula Shama Kitchabrichu, which is the Torah is all Shema Kadisha, is all holy names. The Torah can be read as God's names. And the Ramban in his Hagdama, the Nachmanides in his Hagdama to the Torah, he makes an interesting observation which is quite famous. The Ramban wrote a very famous introduction to his Perush on the Chumash, which is well worth studying. Because it sets out how he views his parish, how he views a number of aspects of Torah. Look, I just brought, we were very short extract in number 8 here. Oid yesh b'yadeinu Kabbalah. We also have a Kabbalah here, it doesn't mean mystical mysticism, it means a tradition. Shel emet, a Kabbalah of emet, and emet is his code word for Kabbalah, for mysticism. We have a Kabbalistic tradition. Ki kol ha-Torah kula shmoysav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That the whole Torah is also God's names. The names can be divided, the words can be divided into names. For example, Breishis can be divided in a different way. Instead of Breishit, Bara Elokim, it can be Barosh, Yit Bara Elokim. Which means originally God was the only thing which was created, was the only thing existing. The whole Torah, okay? The whole Torah you can do this with. Milvat Sirufim, this is apart from the idea of Sirufim, Gematrias, doing other Kabbalistic things. We'll talk about Gematria another time. Very misunderstood Gematria. People don't really know what Gematria is for. Shems. Ukfar Katav Rabbeinu Shlomo. Who's Rabbeinu Shlomo?
Oh, Rashi.
He quotes Rashi, and one of the big questions, by the way, is was Rashi a Kabbalist or not? So many people say, well, Rashi doesn't talk about Kabbalah, but there are a couple of places where Rashi brings these Kabbalistic ideas. There's a whole question about where Kabbalah comes from, which we'll talk about later on when we talk about the Zohar and the Arizal, etc. But Rashi was way before the Arizal, but he says, Rashi writes, he quotes Rabbeinu Shlomo, Beperusha B'Talmud, on his Perush on the Talmud, actually in Sukkah, Inyan Hashem HaGodol, he talks about the big name of God, Shel Ayin Bet of 72 letters, Be'ez Inyan who b'shloisha psukim, in these 3 psukim, v'yisa, v'yavoi, v'yet. Where is v'yisa, v'yavo, v'yet? Did you know when you were reading this?
What was that about Hashem's name of 72 letters?
Hashem has a name of 72 letters. It's a mystical name of God. The Shem of Purush is 4 letters, but there are other longer names. And there's a 72 letter name. And he quotes these 3 psukim. V'yisa, v'yavoi, v'yet. Do you know where that's coming from? Did you have any idea? Did you look at the back of the sheet when I put the thing? Did you see this table on the back?
Yeah.
Did that make any sense to you?
Yeah.
What is this? What is this?
Telling you the Torah codes.
Oh, so you raised the Torah codes, and I want to say this is very much not what the Torah codes is. We'll talk about the Torah codes in a minute. These are psukim. Look at the top one. Look at the top box. Start from the right where Hebrew reads. Vayisa Malach. Okay. Ha'elokim. You can read it. It's a pasuk from Beshalach. These 3 psukim read from number 1 through 72. Sorry, it got chopped up a little bit at the end. And then the second pasuk reads from 72 back through 1. And the third pasuk reads from 1 back through 72.
From what?
Okay. So these actually spell the 3 psukim in the middle of Kriyas Yamsuf. When the Jewish people are standing at Kriyas Yamsuf. And according to Rashi, quoted by the Ramban, these three psukim are actually representative of the 72-letter name of God. Now, I'm not a Kabbalist, guys. I don't have any Kabbalistic training. I don't know what I'm talking about if I talk about Kabbalah, so I'm not going to talk about it. But I do know that the Ramban is telling us that you can also read Torah, even the Torah we have today, you can read Torah on a more abstracted level, which is the 72-letter names of God. This, by the way, is not the same as what today is called the Torah codes. You heard about the Torah codes? Yes, right here. Okay, this is not the same as the Torah codes. You ever heard of the Torah codes?
No.
That's not quite the Torah code.
There's no space between letters and they find words and different meanings.
You write in a grid and you can find crisscross.
The computer programming.
Right. Now, the reason that you're less familiar with the Torah codes is interesting, because had I asked this question 5 years ago, everybody in the class would have been jumping up and going, yeah, the Torah codes. Because the Torah codes have fallen out of favor a little bit. Someone came up with the idea, not so long ago, that statistically, mathematically, you could set out the Torah, picking up on the Ramban, which is real Torah, okay? They said, rather than just doing this, let's see if we can kind of mathematically put the Torah into grids, and then put them in like blocks of like 5, 10, 15, 30, 100, 200, 300, 500, 1,000, whatever, and then see what patterns the Torah letters spell. And that way they purportedly, arguably, found words that show this and show that, etc., etc. The question is this real or is this not real? Is this a legitimate way of presenting the idea that there are coded messages in the Torah? The idea that there are coded messages in the Torah is real. This is a Ramban, it's mainstream Torah. The idea that you can do this in a modern computer program by setting up these artificial, if you like, grids, that is definitely a step beyond. And also, is what they find statistically relevant or not? In other words, there are many people that have claimed since then that you can do exactly the same thing with other books, with other religious books, with other secular books, and you can also, if you're looking hard enough, find, you know, Ronald Reagan and Vladimir Putin or whatever it is you're looking for. Not to mention the idea that you can predict things with the codes, and basically the idea of the Torah codes has been seriously discredited. I brought you on the bottom of page one two articles, references to two articles. What I'm going to try and do for you this year is give you references to other places to read about important things. One of them actually is a useful little article written by an MMY girl from 5771 on the Torah codes. You can get it in Rabbi Lerner's office. As you know, we have a Torah journal called Kol Mevaseret that comes out at the end of every year. Some of the stuff that the girls write in there is, I mean, all of it's good, but some of it's really good, actually. And I've used some of these articles myself to research certain things. All of the back issues are in Rabbi Lerner's room. You could do worse than sit and read a couple, if only just to see what stuff you can come up with. In Hebrew as well, the girls from MMY have been able to produce over the years. So one is an article in there by a young lady I didn't know, because she was before I came to the school. And the called Dvar 11. I'm sure Rabbi Katz would know everything about Dvar 11, because he knows everything about everybody because he has to. And the other is an article by three Rosh Yeshiva that was on Cross Currents. Have you come across Cross Currents? Cross Currents is a very good website. It's like a blog sort of website put together by someone called Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein. You ever heard of him?
No.
Anyone from LA? You all right, Chani? If you're from LA, you'll come across Rav Adlerstein. He's a very intelligent thinker. He has this website called Cross Currents. You look it up on a Google search. This is a very worthwhile article to read about the Torah codes, where three very prominent Mechanchim, Rosh Yeshiva, basically say that it's highly discredited and is not real Torah. However, this that I'm presenting to you here is from the Rishonim, clearly is real Torah, but this is where they're getting the idea from. Now, yes.
The Esther
codes, the little letters, is a different thing. That came before the whole Torah codes. I think there was, who was it that first brought their attention? You know what she's talking about?
Okay.
That within the names of Haman's ten sons, there are some letters which are written small. And if you put those letters together, you get the date of the Nuremberg trials.
Yeah.
And there's a parallel between the killing of the criminals at Nuremberg the execution of the criminals and the death of the sons of Haman, and there are various parallels that you get between the two.
Yeah.
You can read it written up. So I think that is not the same as the Torah codes. I think that that has a little bit more legitimacy to it and more authenticity to it, but you can look it up. But again, it doesn't prove anything. It's just interesting. Yeah? Now, the Ramban goes on to say, if you look at the underlined bit, Benira, number 8, Shahat Torah HaKsuva, the Torah which is written, Be'esh Shchira Al-Gabi Esh Levona. Oh, black fire on white fire. This is a very, very interesting, beautiful Kabbalistic idea, which again comes out of the Yerushalmi. Look in number 9. Rav Pinchas B'Shem Rav Shimon ben Levi says the following: HaTorah Shenatan Lo Kodesh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, the Torah given to Moshe, Nitna Lo Eish Levana Charuta BeEish Shechora, white fire carved out with black fire. He Eish Muvlelet BeEish, fire mixed with fire, Chatsuva MeEish, carved from fire, Nutunim MeEish, given from fire. As it says, Dichsiv, it brings a posik in Devarim, in Vedas Abracha, Miyiminoi, it was given from God's right hand, Eish Dat Lamoi, it was given as a religion of fire, a law of fire. Now, this is all deep stuff, and that's why I brought you that long extract from Rabbi Cordoza's book, The Torah as God's Mind, which I don't even think is in print anymore. It's very hard to get a hold of these days. Did you read it, the English thing?
Yes.
Did it make any sense?
Yes.
I actually think it's very beautiful. It's so interesting, the way that he goes through this. This Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cordoza is actually another controversial figure these days for all sorts of interesting reasons. But he has a lot of, in terms of his reading and thinking of Torah, he's a very interesting man. I know him, he taught me when I was in Ulsanmeach many, many years ago. And he wrote this little book. It's a tiny pamphlet, it's about 30 pages long. And he gives us this beautiful idea of this white fire. What does a white fire represent, he said? This complete primordial Torah, the Torah as quote-unquote God's mind. Moshe can't relate to the white fire because it's the infinite of God. But the white fire begins to coalesce into black fire.
Okay, so
and originally there's...
Primordial Torah and it's infinite?
Yes, because it's part of God. So when we talk about God looking into the Torah and creating the world, what is God looking into? God is looking into God. And he has this beautiful idea at the beginning about the monologue and the dialogue. You got that? Which when you think about, whenever you're about to say something, before you say it, you first work it through in your own mind. There is this monologue which is completely unstructured inside your mind. That's you speaking to yourself before you express it in words. Now, if I were to crack into your mind, I wouldn't be able to put any of that together. It is completely beyond me. In fact, what is it, in fact? Some billions of tiny electrodes sparking in your mind, putting those ideas together. That you speaking to yourself is the parallel to what God is doing when he's speaking, creating the world. When God creates the world, who's he speaking to? Let there be light. He's speaking to himself. It's an internal process. So when he says that God's looking in the Torah is part of God in that sense. It's certainly not the parchment with the ink that we have. That already comes much later. The Torah that exists before God is this white fire. And Rabbi Cordoza here describes how you end up with the letters dancing together to coalesce. He brings all these Kabbalists. Okay, I'm not a Kabbalist. I don't know what all this means. He probably knows it much better than me. But the idea that first what coalesces is God's names. And eventually the Torah, if you like, crystallized it. Imagine a process of crystallization. You ever seen crystals forming?
Yeah.
I know you have to be pretty bored to sit and watch crystals form. But, you know, you did do that at school, making crystals?
Yeah.
So you have this solution, which is all completely mixed together. It's liquid. And then gradually, out of the liquid, crystalline structures form. That's what's going on. Think about it if you're into the idea of the early universe, you know, like the Big Bang and all that stuff, how originally everything existed in the plasma form, and out of the plasma, superheated plasma, billions and trillions of degrees, gradually you end up with things forming first of all, first, you know, neutrons and protons, and then atoms form as it cools, and then molecules begin to bond together as the temperature drops. yeah? And then you end up with stars and planets, etc., and the structure we have now, which is a totally structured universe. But it all comes out of a superheated plasma. So think of that as a marshal, that this is the same idea of what's happening with the Torah. I think that's what's going on here. You can read it again afterwards. I really think it's a fantastic piece to try and understand what's going on here. So again, when we say the Torah was created before the world, we mean the Torah as God's mind, the primordial Torah. Yes. Primordial just means very old, original. Yes. Yeah, the black fire is the beginning of the crystallization of the word that we have. That's the ink. In other words, what role does the white spaces on the parchment play in Torah? This is also a Kabbalistic idea. When you look at a letter written in a Sefer Torah, there's the black ink, and there's also the white spacing around the letter. What does the white spaces around the letter say? Yeah, but what does that spell?
Nothing.
But it has to be there. And by the way, if the white spacing is not there, the Sefer Torah is apostle. If any of the letters touch each other, the Sefer Torah is apostle, Sefer Torah. Sometimes, by the way, the wording can, the letters can, spacing can say something. I'm not very good at drawing letters, but let's just see if I can draw this. Okay, one second. So that's okay, that's very easy. Okay, so if you look at a pay which is written properly, you'll see actually that it goes like this on the pay. Okay? You'll see that inside every pay in a Sefer Torah is a bet. Okay? It's not very clear, so I have with a sofer, I'd be able to write it much more clearly. But next time you get a chance to look, maybe I'll put one on the page next time. Next time you get to look at a letter in the Sefer Torah, you'll see that the white spacing actually spells stuff as well. That's almost like the white fire, yeah, as well. So there's all sorts of stuff going on here that is beyond what meets the eye. Yes, Esti.
Would the first set of Lucha have been just the white fire?
No, I think the Lucha, this was Ellie's question. I think the Lucha, once you get to the idea of the Lucha, it's already a crystallized form. It's already a physical object. The first Lucha is also physical. Maybe Bederech Neis, like the Beis HaLevi said, maybe a physical in a way. Gan Eden, what's Gan Eden? Gan Eden's also physical, but it's physical on a level that it's hard for us to relate to. You know, the idea that at Matan Torah they went back to the level of Gan Eden. So what is it like living in Gan Eden? I don't know. Do you want to live in Gan Eden?
No.
Right, that's because we can't relate to it. It's a physical place, but it's not a physical place.
It's Ramban's idea of the time of Mashiach. I don't
want to
live there.
The Ramban, Nachmanides' idea. Yeah, I hear that. We'll talk about Mashiach later in the year. But for now, just understand this Kabbalistic idea. Now, there are those, just before Hani's question, there are those that understand it more literally, not literally, but more rationally. I brought you on page 5, let's turn to page 5 for a second, a more rationalist approach. I'm not going to read through that whole English thing, obviously. I want you to read it, though. I want you to make sure you've read it. A more rationalist approach, the Ibn Ezra we saw already. The Kuzari, who of course predates the Zohar, so the Kuzari is not going to bring the ideas of the Zohar about the black fire and white fire and all that. The Kuzari basically says that, what does it mean that Torah came before the world? This was a difficult Kuzari to understand, but he says a number of things were said to be created before the world. The Torah, Tzadikim, Yerushalayim, etc. What does all that mean? So he says it means that these are the purpose of the world. The last three words are probably important, the last few words. Hayabidin sheyasuma ela bruyim bekoach. Okay? They were created bekoach in potential kodim ha'olam. Meaning, is there a purpose to the world? Yes. That purpose is Torah, Tzadikim, Gan Eden, Yerushalayim. Again, he's saying this idea, not a Kabbalistic idea anymore, but the idea that if you ask, did God create this world for a purpose? And the answer is absolutely. The purpose is ethics and morality and people to connect with each other, with God, and become, you know, whatever it is that you describe as that purpose. But it's not random, it's not meaningless, not purposeless, like I said before. That's the same idea that the Torah precedes the world, that there is a reason why the world is here. Yes.
Okay,
sorry, Khani's being patient. I'll come to you right now, Khanada. Yes.
The Torah of God's mind thing that about how white fire is actually infinite, which is God, and you're saying that he created it through that.
Does that mean God was created?
No. It means that God somehow crystallizes an element of himself, I don't know what this means exactly, into a format that we can relate to.
No, before the Torah, it said if the Torah was created, and that is God,
well, from our perspective, it looks like a thing separate to God, but from God's perspective, it's God all the same.
What was the point of creation? Why does that even use that word? It just says is.
The Torah is. So you say the Torah wasn't created. If the Torah really is, so it's like the names of God. Are the names of God really God? No. The names of God are a way that we relate to God from our perspective.
Which is the Torah made finite. No, but that doesn't make sense. Because you don't have the Torah that we're talking about relating him anyway. So there's no point in making it
in a respect that we No, but the Torah that we have now is the closest we have to that and can be a way to access that if we know how to read it on a deeper level. Because how can the finite access the infinite?
Because we can't do it anyway.
The Chiddush is we can through Torah.
Right, but not that Torah. The other Torah, the white Torah.
Yeah, but the only way... There is no point in it in and of itself because we can't just rush straight from where we are to an infinite system. But if we go through the system, then you can get closer and closer to it. No, so the white Torah is not God. The white Torah is quote-unquote God's mind. Now, of course, God can't have a mind separate from God on a philosophical level because God is only one. But from our perspective, we always see God in a way that God can't really exist. We can never see God from the God's eye. We can only ever see God from the human eye. So to us, God looks limited. He looks as though... Something was created from our perspective. But, you know, what does it mean, Ein od milvado? You start to get into a Kabbalistic perspective, you have to ask whether anything was created at all. Okay, so I'm not getting into that because it'll fry my mind as well. But, you know, from our perspective, it seems to be created. Mitzidoi mitzidenu. We see God mitzidenu from our perspective. So it looks like that. Anyway, I must go on because otherwise I'm not going to get anywhere. Yes. Okay, fine. It's a little bit too esoteric for me as well. But I wanted you to be aware of it. The rest of the course is not going to be anything like this esoteric. I can promise you that for now. But at least you need to be aware when people talk about the Torah preceding creation, you need to have access to these are where to find the information, whatever that means. Don't worry, next time we're going to be much more down to earth and we're going to get down to the halachic process, etc., etc. But first, before we get exoteric, we can be a little esoteric. Fine. Have a look, please, in source numbers 14 through to the end. Or maybe, actually, I will skip that for now and I will tell you what I was going to tell you about the end of last week's sheet. Which should I do? Last week's sheet. So, fine. So, just before the end, just leave this sheet for now. Yeah, don't worry about it. That's fine, because it's about Gan Eden. It's not really strictly on the point. I just want to point something out from the end of last week's sheet, which I think is very important. In fact, maybe this is the answer to Hannah anyway, because maybe we need to bring ourselves down from the Kabbalistic, esoteric plane to something much more real. Not real to us in terms of concrete. We talked last time about the idea that the Torah had to remain oral. The oral Torah had to remain oral for many reasons. And what were the reasons? We talked about the fact that the oral Torah is much closer, more intimate with a person, that the oral Torah separates us from the non-Jewish world and gives us the keys to access the Torah. We talked about the fact that the oral Torah was much more flexible, was there to introduce an element of autonomy. We talked about all this, right? Mm-hmm. What we didn't really talk about is the last one. There were a couple in the middle as well, that keeping the oral Torah oral allows it to be only available to those people who can really understand it and stops us splitting into many different groups. But I just want to talk about this last point, which is that keeping the oral Torah oral makes the Torah your Torah. It allows you to be a partner with God in creation. This is a very interesting idea. Look at the first pasuk in Tehillim, in number 19. Ashrei ha'ish asher lo yhalach ba'atzas rishayim. Happy is the person who didn't follow the way of the rishayim. U'b'derech ha'taim lo yamad, and he didn't go down the way of sin. U'b'moshev leitzim lo yashav, and he didn't sit with the people who sit and scoff. Ki im tayra im b'tayras Hashem chetzoi. That he is with the Torah of God. U'b'tayrasai Yega Yom Amalaya, and he works in his own Torah day and night. So the Gemara picks up on this point that originally it was called the Torah of God. But once you've been learning it, it transfers from being God's Torah to your Torah. Amar Rabba B'Tchila, number 20, Nikris al Shmoy Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Originally it's called the Torah of God. Ula B'Sof Nikra al Shmoy, then it's called your Torah. Shneimar, and he goes through that pasuk. What's happened here? So what's happened here is with the oral Torah, you can have an involvement in the process of Torah, which you can never have with Torah Shebichtav. And that's what God wants you to do. If you look for a second in Source 21, I'll leave you with this very beautiful midrash. Pam achad hayiti mahalach b'derech, says the Eliyahu Zutzit, is meant to come from tradition from Eliyahu Navi. So he says, once it was that I was walking on the way, b'derech u'matzani adam echad, I found a man, uba elai b'derech minut, and he came to me with heretical ideas. Yesh bo mikra ve'ein bo mishnah. He believed in Chumash, but he didn't believe in Torah Sheval Peh. Amalei said to me, Mikra nitzen lanu mihar Sinai. The Torah, the written Torah, yes, I accept that came from Sinai. Mishnah, but the Mishnah, the oral Torah, lo nitzen lanu mihar Sinai. It wasn't given to us from Har Sinai. What do you have to say to that? Amarti loy, and I said to him, Bani, my son. The haloi mikra v'mishnah mepia gvurin emru, wasn't mishnah and mikra given from God? Ma bein mikra l'mishnah. Let me tell you the difference between the written Torah and the oral Torah. Look at what he says. Mashloi mashal. He gave him a mashal. Lama David doimer. I'm on the third line of 21. Lemelech basar v'dam. Shehaya loy shnei avadim. You may have heard the mashal before. There was a king who had two servants. V'haya oyevam ava gemura. And he loved them all very deep, both very deeply. He gave each of them a bag of wheat. This one he gave a bag of wheat. This one he gave a bag of wheat. This one he gave a bundle of flax. Flax is from a plant. So what do they do with it? The clever servant, Ma'asa, what did he do? He took the flax, and he made it into linen, and he made a beautiful white tablecloth. He took the wheat, the asan sorted, he made flour, birara, he did boira, tachna, then he ground it, lasha, then he kneaded it, va'af, and he baked it, v'sidra agave ashulchan, he laid it out on a table, uparatale amapa, and he laid out the cloth on the table, v'nichad shaloi ba'amalef, and he set out the bread for the king. Hatipesh, the stupid one, loy asa v'loy klum, he did nothing. Later on, Bahamelech, the king came, and he said to them, Banais, my children, show me what I gave you. Echad, one of them, Hoiti es pas, Hasolis, he gave the beautiful bread, Agabi Shulchan, over the table with a white linen tablecloth. The Echad, Hoiti es achitiv, Kupanino, and gave him a bag of wheat, and gave him a bag of flax. So the Gemara answered, the Mishnah, the Midrash says, Oilala Oisa Busha, what a terrible embarrassment. Oilala Oisa Chlima, what an awful disgrace. Have Oime Ezimehem Chavid, which one of these two servants has impressed the king more? The one who's taken the raw material given to him and made it into something that is unbelievably refined, much more than what was originally given. So when God gave the Torah to Israel, he gave it to us as wheat to bring forth beautiful flour, ukepishdan and flax, to make beautiful cloth. Meaning, the Torah is not meant to just be raw material to be kept as raw material. It's meant to be used, says this Midrash, by people in order to create something which on a certain level is even superior to what was originally given. That's what Torah Sheba'al Peh is for. Torah Sheba'al Peh is often compared to wine. What's the deal with wine? Why is it like wine? Wine is something that is superior to the thing that originally grew on the tree. What's the brocha on a grape? What's the brocha on wine? What's the brocha on an orange? What's the brocha on orange juice? So what happened with an orange? God made a beautiful orange. What could be better than the orange? You squeeze it, you ruin it, you downgrade it. It's lower than the original orange. Then the bracha goes down. But you take grapes. and you crush them and you ferment them and you turn them into beautiful wine, you've taken God's creation and upgraded it. So the bracha upgrades as well. So too, Torah Shebaal Peh is meant to be a joint exercise and endeavor between God and man, where man takes the Torah that was given to him by God, and not only takes it and learns it, but learns it, internalizes it, makes it his, and improves it. Oh, so all of this should make you very excited about why Torah Shebaal Peh is Torah Shebaal Peh, and also at the same time very frustrated about the fact that we don't have it anymore. We'll talk about why that is. And don't worry, next time will be less esoteric.